Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Karma's gonna get you. Gonna knock you right on the head.
You better get yourself together. Pretty soon you're gonna be dead.
Well, maybe instant karma got to John Lennon. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and out of all the Beatles, John Lennon had the most interesting and most confounding life. He cheated on his first wife, Cynthia, cruelly dismissed their son, Julian, left them penniless when Beatlemania was at its height. With Yoko Ono, he was prone to displays of insecurity, jealousy, and colossal self-absorption. John Lennon was also extraordinarily talented. His songwriting partnership with Paul McCartney bore some of the finest pop songs of the 20th century, and an exhaustive new biography explores the roots of Lennon's many contradictions and contributions. The book is called John Lennon, The Life, and its author is Philip Norman. He joins us today. Philip, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, you wrote the 1981 book Shout about the Beatles, which is, you know, acclaimed as a really, you know, important biography of the group collectively. Why come back to John in particular and at such length in this new book?
Sharp really was a collective portrait, and that was a sketch of John. I felt John needed a full-length portrait in oils. In fact, when I researched this book, I found there were some judgments, indeed some facts in Shout that I had to correct. I felt that, of course, a long time has gone by since Shout, and John Lennon is still in the world. He's still such a presence. You know, he still means so much to people who weren't even born when he was killed.
So 1981, just a year after Lennon's death, the book comes out. What were some of the misconceptions that you found yourself needing to clear up a quarter century later?
The main discovery for me in this book is John's character. I mean, I portray him in Shout as a very sarcastic and tough, romantic, but still, you know, pretty ruthless character. There was much more to him than that. Every sort of quality of John is contradicted by another quality. On a pure factual level, the mythology of his having been born during a heavy air raid on Liverpool by the German Air Force in the Second World War. That was told to me by his Aunt Mimi. I did speak to his Aunt Mimi, who brought him up when I did the Shout book. Then I finally checked the records, and indeed, there were heavy air raids on Liverpool all through the week of John's birth. But on the night of his birth was the only night when the Luftwaffe did not visit Liverpool. Mimi confused it probably with the next night when she went to the hospital and there were landmines falling on parachutes. But no, it wasn't actually true. It was a peaceful night, that mm-hmm. one night.
The book is 850 pages long, but the reviewers are by and large focusing on two pages that talk about John Lennon and his apparently sexual feelings towards his own mother, who did not raise him. He was raised largely, as you mentioned, by his Aunt Mimi. Where did you get that information from?
Well, I have to say, I mean, in fairness, the reviewers are not only focusing on that. I mean, the tabloids have been rather more sort of inclined to pick up that. But it's very important in the context not only of John's life but his music. And earlier on you played the song Julia, which his mother's name was Julia. His mother had handed him over to his Aunt Mimi, who was extremely straight-laced, very, very strong woman who lived in middle-class gentility, the working-class hero, as he called himself, growing middle-class gentility, suburbia. But his mother was still in his life. Julia, his mother, was around, living not far away with another man with whom she had two children. She was very beautiful. She was very flirtatious, very eccentric, and she fascinated John. And as he got full of testosterone in his teens, he started, because she wasn't like a mother figure, she was more like a sort of flirtatious older cousin, he started to think, well, what if there were a sexual encounter between us? Boys do this. I remember doing it myself. Not about my mother, but about older women. And there was one day when they were alone in the house where Julia lived, and he just thought there might have been a sexual moment between them. Now, he never got over this because his mother was run over and killed outside his Aunt Mimi's front gate not long after that, and John never got over this tragedy, and right to the end of his life was still obsessing about that moment when he might have perhaps had this encounter with his mother.
Well, and as you said, Philip, this is important not just to understand John Lennon's character, but also some of the music. And it's not just a song like Julia, but you can hear it coming out in a song like this one called Mother.
Mother!
song is called Mother by John Lennon, the subject of the book John Lennon, The Life. Philip Norman is the author. He's also the author of the 1981 Beatles biography Shout, The Beatles in Their Generation, and my guest on Soundcheck today. One of the strengths of the book is it's a very frank kind of writing about John, both, you know, the good and the bad. And one of the things that it seems is hardest to write about is the suggestion, which cropped up at various points during John's life, of homosexual feelings, because there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of evidence of anything happening here, there, or whatever. What do you make, ultimately, of the suggestions that John, for example, had other than purely platonic feelings towards Paul?
He didn't. Paul was a colleague. They were colleagues. They were never really that sort of close friends, even. They were professionals working together. But John wanted to be what he called a real artist, a real, in quotation marks, artist, which, of course, Yoko was, which counts for their relationship. And he thought a real artist should be open to every experience. And it came to him at one point or other, if he wanted to be like Matisse or Van Gogh and he wanted to be open to everything, perhaps that should include a homosexual relationship. Who would it be? The young man most in his life at the time was Paul McCartney. They would share rooms together in hotels. They would share beds, but there was never a suggestion of anything between them. But John was securely heterosexual, so secure that he didn't mind playing around on the margins. He would exploit the fact that Brian Epstein, the Beatles manager, adored him. Brian was gay. Brian loved John. John could use that. He could use that to consolidate his position as the leader of the Beatles, which he did.
Wasn't there a weekend that the two of them, Brian Epstein and John, spent in, was it Spain?
Yes, it was known as the honeymoon.
The honeymoon.
It was just at the time when just after John's first son, Julian, had been born. It was a most ill-advised thing to have done. But it's been... Brian Epstein told his best friend at the time what had happened, and there might have been a most superficial sexual encounter of John saying, oh, for God's sake, if it means that much to you, okay, you know. But he was securely heterosexual. Later on, when he met Elton John, he liked playing around with campness. Elton's circle were very camp, and they gave John a woman's name, which was Catherine. But that amused John. But, uh-huh. It was put to me he was secure enough in being straight that he could play around.
And again, you know, it comes out in the music, in the terrific collaboration with Elton John, the song Whatever Gets You Through the Night.
Whatever gets you through the night.
Whatever gets you through the night, John Lennon with Elton John. My guest is Philip Norman. He is author of the massive new book called John Lennon, The Life. You talked to Paul McCartney, obviously at some length.
By email.
Mm-hmm. Was this all new material, or did you go back to, you know, notes? I mean, you had met John, of course.
I had met John. I was thrown out of the Beatles' dressing room in 1965 as a newcomer to journalism.
For what reason?
Just being
a newcomer?
No, just being there. I was talking to John and Paul and Ringo, and they made me feel like their oldest friend. And I said, oh, can I stay around a bit longer? They said, oh, sure, sure. Then the roadie, Neil Aspinall, came in and said, out. That was the way it was done. Later on, I was in the Apple House, really, when it was all breaking up. And I spent the morning in John and Yoko's office when they were being a kind of helpline to the world. So I did have that sort of, you know, firsthand experience of John, but I couldn't say I really knew him.
Well, let me ask you something. I mean, you mentioned you were there in the Apple House when things were finally at their end. We've been talking about the White Album and the 40th anniversary of the White Album. Do you hear that as the sound of a band disintegrating?
Yes, you do. But the strange thing is then they make the Abbey Road Album, which is the sound of a band that sound totally close together. The harmonies just are just as close as when they were, you know, touring around in a van as the Beatles in the early days. So it was a sort, but it was a kind of battleground for lots of reasons. And of course, the main one was that John's idea, it wasn't that Yoko broke up the Beatles. John wanted her to be a Beatle. So she was in the studio with him, and that there was a lot of tension. But they were very patient about it.
Now, did you set out in this book to rehabilitate the image of Yoko, or did you find yourself learning stuff as you went through the process of research?
Well, she got the most dreadful treatment at the time in the UK. I mean, racist abuse. It was not long after the Second World War, of course, but that's no excuse. Also, her kind of art was completely alien to the British mainstream culture. So she was called a lunatic and she was insulted racially. And, of course, tagged with this sort of stigma that she had broken up the Beatles when nothing further from the truth could be imagined. And she did talk to me for hours and hours when I was researching this book. And I thought, yes, a dreadful injustice had been done to her. And it's still there somehow. People still resent her.
Now, she, as you say, was quite generous with her time in the making of the book. But after reading the manuscript, decided that she could not, you know, kind of support the book, write a blurb for the cover or something because you were mean to John.
Well, you can tell by the way I'm talking that I'm not meanly disposed to John.
Yeah.
I don't understand this, and I'm hoping when she reads the reviews, all of which say this is a thoroughly positive and affectionate, even respectful portrait of John, that she may change her mind. I hope she does.
You also had a chance to speak to Cynthia, his first wife?
Yes, in passing. I had spoken to her for Shout. I didn't feel there was much to add, really, and she has written two books of her own.
But getting Sean Lennon to write about his father.
Yes, he spoke. He spoke about his father.
That really is the first time on record, isn't it, that,
yes,
that Sean has done this?
Yeah, yeah. I was introduced to him when he was 13. He did say a few words then about his memories of John. This was the first time he really talked about the night of John's death, or the morning after, rather. Sean was only 5 years old. He woke up in the apartment at the Dakota Building and couldn't understand why his father wasn't there. Lots of strangers in the apartment and crowds of people outside. And he was told, you know, the news was broken to him that his father had been killed.
And it sort of casts a light ahead, you know, into a future where there is no John Lennon. But if he hadn't died that night, had he reached some kind of point in his life where he was kind of getting his act together?
Yes, John was always a very insecure person, very, very jealous and very insecure, even insecure about his talent. He told George Martin, the Beatles producer, he wanted to re-record all the Beatles material, including, especially, he said, Strawberry Fields, I mean, one of his masterpieces. But he was always looking for something to make him feel better about being John Lennon, whether it was drugs, meditation, therapy. And the cure really turned out to be looking after this little boy and making Sean's life feel secure, made John's feel more secure. So the final album released, you know, just before his death, Double Fantasy, there is a much quieter and more mellow John on that album.
And it seemed like he had kind of settled in here in New York into a routine as, you know, the house husband, as he referred to himself.
Yes, although John was like another revolutionary from British culture, George Orwell, who railed against the establishment and the government, but still was deeply patriotic about things like fish and chips and warm beer, Cotswold villages. And John wanted to go back to Britain and was actually planning to charter the QE2, the liner, and sail up the Mersey back to Liverpool. He was serious. and I think he would have been living back in Britain.
So did Sean give you a sense of how he was? I mean, could he have given you a sense of how he was as a father?
Absolutely, because we think that childhood memories have to be unhappy to be memorable, but Sean's memories with John were very happy. They stopped when Sean was only five, but he remembered things like, you know, the feel of John's face, the stubble on his chin sitting on his lap, the way he would read him a story or sing him a song at night and then switch the light off in time to his name. Little tiny sort of domestic details, very, very moving.
So why did that relationship with Yoko and with Sean work so well when the first go-round with Cynthia and Julian was such a mess?
Because John was just getting famous with the Beatles, because he had to marry Cynthia because she was pregnant. You know, the thing about pop stars is they can be adolescents forever. And as long as John was a Beatle, he was kept in adolescence. He had to grow up by being with Yoko and coming to New York and facing, you know, the persecution of the Nixon government, over his immigration status, really to grow up, and finally to be a father, to grow up.
We're speaking with Philip Norman. His book is called John Lennon, The Life. I mentioned 850-odd pages. There's, in the center of the book, a series of photographs, one of which is John Lennon with Yoko Ono by his side, holding the green card, which, as you write, was actually blue, but, you know, that he worked so hard to get. Now, how do you said before he was very patriotic, you know, loved fish and chips and Cotswold villages and the whole, you know, the kind of England as God's green and pleasant land. Why was he so hell-bent on getting that card that he spent years of his life going after it?
Well, because, I mean, he was trapped in America, in New York, really, and it became a sort of obsession. He wanted to be here. Yoko's daughter was in the U.S., Yoko's daughter by her previous husband. They were trying to get this little girl back, so he wanted to be with Yoko while she looked for Kyoko. Actually, she never found Kyoko in John's lifetime. That was the main reason he wanted to be in America. And just, you know, he liked New York. New York was a refuge after London. London had got very unpleasant for John.
He was very early on, as you say, you know, at the height of Beatlemania, sort of kept in adolescence by the adulation, the easy access to women and drugs and all the rest of it. Was he able to grow up in New York where you don't have to look far to find the same things?
Yeah, he retired. He didn't retire from making music, but from the business. He stayed at home. He did normal things. He foot-slogged around with a stroller with a baby in it. You know, he did those things he hadn't done for his first son. That did give his life a measure of sanity.
Right. The book is called John Lennon, The Life. There are mysteries both old and more recent in Lennon's life that, as you said at the beginning of our conversation, you felt you needed to go back and kind of correct some misconceptions, things like that. The story of Norwegian Wood, one of John's earliest great songs. What's the story ultimately behind this?
Well, this track, this song, it, to me, is sort of evidence of the John that John kept secret, which is the self-disciplined John, the wordsmith, the intellectual. That song in 26 lines is like a little play by Samuel Beckett of a young man who is John sitting in a girl's flat who's a bit sort of upper class, and he's intimidated, doesn't know whether to make a move on her or not. And in the end, it says, "I lit a fire." Does it mean he torched the flat? What happened? You know, it was always supposed to be a journalist in London. But it was actually the wife of a photographer who lived under the Lennons' flat in West London. She was German, but she said she was Norwegian.
Ah.
And they had a flat that was paneled in wood, and they were having an affair at the time. That's the key.
That is the story behind the song, Norwegian Wood. More in John Lennon, The Life, the book by Philip Norman. Philip, thank you for being with us on Soundcheck today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. For every changing New York neighborhood, the story is similar. Artists and bohemians begin quietly moving in. Then comes the trendy coffee shop, the crepe restaurant, the fancy hairdresser, and finally the multi-million-dollar condo. So considering that artists are the pioneers in discovering the next best neighborhood, Soundcheck invited musicians and creative minds around the city to name their favorite cultural destination. Our web map, called Noteworthy New York, features coffee shops, parks, restaurants, museums, bars, and more. Check out what artists have to say about each one of them and give us your own pick. Go to wnyc.org/noteworthynewyork or follow the link on the Soundcheck page. And just to whet your appetite, we'll hear from Brian Devendorf, the drummer of the indie rock band The National. He tells us why he chose the Melody Lanes Bowling Alley in Brooklyn's Sunset Park as his favorite destination in New York.
Well, when I've been here on, like, you know, weekend nights, Friday, Saturday night, there's sort of a subway car kind of demographic. You know, there's, like, everybody of all kinds is here. So I think that would be the most natural, like, New York element, that there's no kind of, I don't know, very community-oriented. People bring their kids, put the bumpers out. You know, it's just like, it's a fun place. It's like, people come here to have fun. I mean, from where we sit, you can see there's many different colors of pastel and Day-Glo paint, and, you know, it's a relic, I guess, of a more innocent time. Plus, like, the soundtrack is, I think, evocative of Beat Street era, or, like, Electric Boogaloo, stuff like that. There's, like, there's funny graphics when you roll a strike or a spare. There's lots of, like, you know, animation. If it were later, the bar would be open, and the, you know, kooky bartender, this guy Peter, he's been written about in other places. He's kind of like out of The Shining or something, but I think he's sort of like a kind of New York archetype guy with like a, you know, past, who maybe embellishes that past to anybody who'll listen, but no, he's like a character. I've come here with members of the band. We have this thing called Brawling. It's like all the bros get together, come out. Friends in other bands, it's kind of like, come out. We just basically drink a lot and shout out lines from like the Big Lebowski. You think you're young, you're middle class. They say it doesn't matter.
That's Brian Devendorf, drummer of the Brooklyn band The National, explaining why he chose Melody Lane's bowling alley as his noteworthy New York destination. To find out more about his pick and dozens of others, including mine and the rest of the Soundcheck staff, or to nominate your own destination, just visit the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org. That'll do it for the show today. Tomorrow on Soundcheck, is iTunes the music biz savior or destroyer? We'll have another Soundcheck Smackdown. And members of the experimental indie group Grizzly Bear join us with their side project, the duo Department of Eagles, and they'll play live. Soundcheck's technical director is Irene Trudell. Our engineer today was Paul Schneider. The program is produced by Joel Meyer and Brian Wise, who also produced our feature on Noteworthy New York. Our executive producer is Gisele Regatow, and we had help today from Daniel Capalbo. I'm John Schaefer. Be with us again at this time tomorrow for the next Soundcheck.